sir. And he made a body movement very like a bow. Nothing had changed in the wine shop. The same dusty, musty smell. Mr. Prentice clucking and nodding. Mr. Prentice, you look well, and I trust you do well. Indeed, just a visit. And as much as I would like to explore the Hawk, I have come on a different errand. I wish to have my cellar crated and shipped to new quarters in Detroit. But I fear breakage and disturbance will wreak havoc on the contents unless the job is carefully undertaken. Can you advise me of the best way we may do this? Mr. Duke, to disturb those hundreds of bottles, to crate and jostle them halfway across the continent, would ruin a great portion. It would be a true sin. Why not trade with me? A move from your cellar to my shop is not a great journey. In exchange, I will give you a greater measure of aged Madeira or whatever else you like in casks and barrels that can stand the trip without damage. That seems a logical course of action. Let us do it. They spoke for a while, and then the merchant asked offhandedly if Freegrace's cellar had been sold or passed to a family member. It passed to me, said James. Freegrace's will left it to Edward, but Edward's possessions have become mine. I haven't thought of Freegrace's cellar, though I always heard it was very good. His eyes kept straying to the bottles. He looked forward to an excellent dinner, with wine and more wine. Very good. I should say it was very good, among the best in Boston. He coughed. If you think of disposing of it, I would be interested in buying. I would never consider moving those rare bottles any distance. Well, said James, I do not know the extent of what he had, but I have a set of keys at my house. Shall we meet tomorrow morning and examine what is there? Nothing would delight me more, said Mr. Prentice, suddenly sneezing. Shall we meet here at 10? Excellent. Now, Mr. Duke, will you take a glass of Amontillado with me? I will, said James. It will set me right. I keep having bouts of malaise. Are you sure you would not rather have a hot toddy? No, no. Amontillado is what I crave. And please send a half dozen of the Hawk you mentioned round to Black Swan. I must have something to drink while I am here, though I can certainly make inroads on my cellar. I advise it, said Mr. Prentice. If you have special wines, this visit would be the very best time to enjoy them. Now, just step into the tasting room. James felt it was good to be back in Boston, and tonight, he said to himself, a very good dinner. He had a headache the next morning and sent it on its way with a large glass of champagne and the most savorous coffee he'd had in a year, taken at Bliss's Coffee House, where not even the waiter had changed, old Henry with the great wen on his chin, who greeted him by name. The morning was sharp with frost, the hired horse lively. He drove up to the wine shop where Mr. Prentice's florid, smiling face floated in the window. The door opened, and the wine merchant skipped out, carrying an abacus and a notebook. I heard that Mr. Freegrace Duke kept a cellar book, and I thought I would count bottles with this. He held the instrument aloft, and take a few notes. He was in high humor. It seemed to James he had never left Boston, so familiar was this street, the clopping of the horse. Brisk day, he said. The headache was quite gone. He felt very well. Sea air was certainly healthier than lake vapors. Hee up! Brisker to come. The almanac promises a hard winter. I suppose the winters are pleasanter in Michigan. I would not say that, said James. Never would I say that. Inside Freegrace's house, everything was coated with dust. There were a great many tracks on the floor. No sheets protected the furniture. The house was bitterly cold. Only a few months ago, I paid his butler a year's salary to stay on and look after the place until we could make arrangements, said James. It looks as though he left as soon as I did. What was the fellow's name? Eccles, I think. I will look into this. Damn! I will have him taken up. Well, never mind. Let us find a lantern and some candles and go down into the cellar. The door to the cellar was ajar, and as they went down the broad stairs, James noticed chunks of plaster and mud on the stairs and gouge marks on the wall.
"I don't like the look of this," he said, pointing at the plaster dust with his toe.
Mr. Prentice made a clucking sound. He knew what they would find. He had seen it once before. The bottle racks were empty, the cask cradles empty, shelves tipped over. Broken glass glinted in the light of their lantern, and the air had a winey stench. Free Grace's wine cellar had been stripped. They turned to each other and spoke as one.
"The butler!"
And James was impressed to see tears in Prentice's little eyes. The Adam's apple bobbed in his turkey neck. James drove Prentice back, then went to the new formed police office and told of Free Grace's missing wine. Two men James thought rather thick-minded came with him and looked at the shambles in the cellar. They pointed out circles in the dust on the sideboards where silver chafing dishes and other ornaments had once stood. In 5 minutes, they concluded that a criminal gang of immigrants must have done the deed.
"Coming in Boston by the thousand," said one.
Likely an immigrant himself, thought James.
"But the butler," he said, to no response.
They went out. He went into the library, for what, he did not know, picked up the several old copies of Burton's Gentleman's Magazine on the table, something to read at least. He returned to Mr. Prentice and made the arrangements to exchange most of his bottles for casks of Madeira to travel by cart to Albany, then by canal and lake steamer to Detroit.
"At least we can do that much."
But he saw the wine merchant was still grieving the loss of Free Grace's cellar, and shifting James's wines would be little consolation.
"The terrible sin of that theft. I'll warrant the swine did not know what they had. I have heard for years that Mr. Free Grace possessed Chateau de Cam Sauternes from Thomas Jefferson's private cellar, the 1784 vintage. And I heard of a 1792 vintage Madeira. Madeira is truly the prince of old wines, at its best after half a century. The 1792 would just now be coming into maturity. Open a fine old bottle, and it fills the room with such rich, deep aromatics."
He broke off and turned away from the light. The actual taking up of the Black Swan bottles and Mr. Prentice's excruciatingly slow methods of packing and transferring the bottles to his shop delayed James's return by nearly 10 days. The blazing autumn faded, and November rain began the morning after Guy Fawkes Day, which Bostonians still called Pope Day, drowning the last smoldering bonfires. A day or two later, the first line storm to screech off the Atlantic shook the oak outside his old bedroom window and brought down the dead leaves. The house agent called. He had sent a letter saying that he represented a leading Bostonian and wished to discuss a real estate purchase with Mr. Duke. James knew the man was the son of one of the shareholders in the New England Mississippi Land Company, which a few decades earlier had enjoyed a controversial congressional appropriation of more than $1 million. Now the son, who had inherited the windfall, offered $90,000 for Black Swan and its grounds. James pretended reluctance and was finally persuaded to part with the property, house, and all its contents, save his small inlaid table, which would travel with him to Detroit, for a rather larger sum. The next day he put Edward's place, Free Grace's rifled mansion, and even Leonard Vogel's handsome brick federal-style house in the agent's hands. A week before Thanksgiving, he began his own return passage. The wine would follow. In his stateroom on the steamer Liberty Tree, he read the last Burton's Gentleman's Magazine and was disturbed by a story, The Fall of the House of Usher, the opening paragraphs unpleasantly reminiscent of his cousin's ravaged house. He had a sore throat. He was coming down with a cold. The worst place to have a cold was on a steamer on Lake Erie in winter. In his valise, he had a copy of Nicholas Nickleby for Lavinia. He would read this. So the last leg of the tedious and cold journey began, with James wincing at the antics of Mr. Squeers, who certainly would not have balked at stealing a cellarful of wine. He felt it before he knew what he felt. His own marine experience lay in the days of sail on the Atlantic, but he sensed the change in the beat of the inland sea, the increasingly labored response of the steamer. He knew that the Great Lakes, and especially Erie, were among the most treacherous waters of the earth, and that the winter storms wrecked ships as men trod wildflowers. Duke and Sons had lost 2 lumber boats the last winter, delighting settlers along the shore with planks that floated to them with no labor but to bend over and pick them up. He read on but felt the cold. When he got up to search for his heavy coat, he nearly fell with the ship's violent pitch. He could hear it groaning now, every timber twisting as the vessel gyred through mountainous waves. He put on his coat, a hat, heavy gloves, and went out on deck. A savage wind blew spume off the tops of the waves. It was a fresh gale, and God, it was cold. His first breath of the sharp air wakened his old headache, which struck like a hurled rock. Ice formed as he watched, along the rail, on the deck, on every rope, the hatch covers, heavy, deep blue ice, tons of it. With fascination, he watched it glaze the front of his coat. He felt his eyebrows weighted. The footing was treacherous. Passengers coming out of their cabins to see how the ship did gasped in the searing cold, and one heavy man immediately fell and slid across the deck, but was able to cling to the bottom rail. He could not get up again, and at each lurch of the ship his feet swung outward over the abyss. James saw ice forming on the man's legs. Could James reach him? He could not. He looked for rope, saw a coil, but it was frozen in a great lump of ice. Passengers were clinging to anything they could reach. James wondered if he could get back to his cabin and try to step without relinquishing his hold on the rail. His foot skidded, and he gave it up. People were shrieking now, calling, "Help! Help!" Never in his life had he felt such cold. 2 icicles hung from his snotty nostrils. The fallen man suddenly shot away under the rail and into Erie. The entire ship was sealed in a casket of ice 1 foot thick, and it labored and wallowed in the troughs of the waves, slower, lower. Why had no crewman chipped ice as soon as it started to form, James wanted to ask, but his mouth could not shape the words. Through the sheeting spray, he thought he saw land nearby, less than 1 mile distant. They were making for a local harbor, or at least the lee of an island, and he felt cheered. He would last. He'd been through worse. The wind pushed the helpless Liberty Tree on, and 1/4 mile from a desolate, stump-choked shore, she smashed onto the foaming rocks. He knew he would never drink that damn Madeira, but with a bizarre sense of victory, he felt his headache become a dwindling spicule. Cyrus had the news first from the steamship owner and came for Lavinia.
"We must go there," she said. "We cannot wait. It is my father. We must go to him."
It took them 2 days to reach the shore near the wreck through some of the coldest weather of the century. Cyrus was exhausted by Lavinia's agitation, her restless head tossing and weeping. The bitter temperatures persisted until the entire Erie shore humped up in crystalline domes of ice. Among the stumps, converted to glittering ice cylinders, they found 30-odd frozen bodies where loggers, summoned from their chopping work 1 mile distant, had laid them. The passengers were frozen in angular postures just as they'd been when the blood solidified in their veins. Many had hands crooked in their last grasp of rope or rail, and the faces fixed in final expressions of struggle or resignation. The captain in his ice uniform held an ice watch in his solid hand. They found James, congealed eyes glaring up at the sky, his tight lips narrow as a crack. Lavinia touched his marble cheek. She looked at Cyrus. He made a hopeless gesture and said, "We shall meet him in heaven." Some of the shantymen were trying to salvage the last bits of rigging and spars, still tumbling in the heavy surf. Lavinia called to a man whose rounded back and sloping shoulders she somehow knew.
Mr. Roby? Oh, oh, it really is you, Mr. Roby. You can do me a very great favor, and I will pay you for it. My father, James Duke, lies among those bodies. I must have him brought to Detroit so we may bury him. Will you help me?
The man looked in her face, white as dirty old snow, tracked with frozen tears.
What? Mr. James Duke? Your father? Oh, Jesus and Mary, Miss Duke, I will. We'll take him out soon as we may, and I'll take no pay for it.
I'll never forget this kindness, she said.
Now she was alone, except for Cyrus and Clara, who did not count. She had encountered aloneness in the hated English school, and now with James buried in the Mount Elliot Cemetery and Posey buried in Boston, the uncles all dead, it was the same. She lay on her bed and tried to breathe slowly. She breathed, breathed, and then almost heard the saddest sound in the world, the far notes of a piano played in an empty room. Re, mi, fa, sol.
Mama! Mama!
Hours later in the dark, she woke, her heart galloping, her salty face stuck to the silk pillow slip. Why had she not thought of this before? She was not alone. There was someone who would protect her, care for her. Although he was a common man, she sensed he had a noble character, no matter what they said. She got out of bed, lit the oil lamp, and began to write. Her pen gouged into the paper page after page, ink sputtering, and when she stopped, it was milky dawn. She folded the pages, wrapped, sealed, and addressed the packet. She felt a sense of completion, knew she had saved herself. Very tired, she crept back into the chilled bed and slept. She rose at noon, dined on a poached chicken breast. She carried her letter to the post office and saw it on its way. Now she could only wait. She was not anxious. He would not fail her. The days passed and Lavinia began to fret. After 10 days, there was still no response. She threw herself at the office work, but it was hourly apparent that she could not run Duke and Sons by herself. She arranged a meeting with Mr. Edward Pye. James had brought Pye, the company's accountant, treasurer, and paymaster, to Detroit and settled him in a house near the Duke offices. Mr. Pye, pale-faced with dark curling hair and beard, was reticent and responsible, the ideal employee. But he had a way of pointing out Duke and Sons' deficiencies that Lavinia could not quite like. He introduced her to a Chicago lawyer visiting Detroit on business, Clayton Jasper Flentz. Within 2 weeks, Flentz had become indispensable. He advised her to shift the company to Chicago. Chicago had a far better geographical location than Detroit. It was central to the entire country. It was becoming an important city. He advised her to incorporate and name a board of directors.
Very many businesses do incorporate. For then, anything the company may choose to do, if some action excites litigation, why, such an attack does not fall on you nor on any individual director, but on the corporation, which is a thing and not a person. It is a legal protection, you see. And this is a way you can raise capital to purchase extensive woodlands. Your investors enjoy limited liability, that is, they face no losses greater than their invested monies. Incorporation is one of the great benefits to business in this country. Incorporation lies with the states, not the central government, and if you are not content in one state and the opportunities look better in another, why, you may go there. It is the lifeblood of our American spirit of enterprise. We do not have tyrannical kings and despots squeezing us into poverty. We can invent and make and work and do and keep the fruits of our labor.
But my father said that corporations were often monopolies, and that they would prove fatal to partnerships and sole proprietor situations. He cited the East India Company as an example.
That was hardly an American institution. Remember, too, that it was a royal charter under the protection of the British government and under its thumb. The thing American people fear about corporations is that they might achieve too much power. We have an antipathy to power even as we admire it, and I believe competition among corporations will make that concern null and void.
She did see. She thought she understood the situation. It was time to reshape Duke and Sons. And every day she waited for the answer to that painful letter written in the night. Flence and Pye were valuable, but she needed an assistant, someone who could act as secretary, handle the paperwork and office supplies, oversee other employees, manage visitors and business callers. She put a small advertisement in the Democratic Free Press and Michigan Intelligencer for a responsible woman with a sense of order. The advertisement brought only two responses. The first was a bony 18-year-old girl wild to get away from her father's stump farm. She was alternatively doubled over with shyness and forthright. She picked nervously at bleeding cuticles and seemed to have only a few qualifications beyond her desire to escape farm life.
"I can read, I can write, I can learn," she said, when Lavinia asked what skills she had. "I admire your spirit, but that may not be enough, Miss Heinrich. I will keep your name in my book and let you know if we have a suitable opening in future."
The second applicant was a middle-aged, rusty-haired widow, Annig Duncan, thin, with long, spider-leg fingers. She had a low, easy voice.
"I worked in the office of a hat manufacturer in Glasgow before I met my husband, Alistair Duncan. Then I stayed to home. We married, and he wanted to come to the New World and make a living as a purveyor of fine woods. He knew what was desirable. We went to New York, but his cough... He had a little cough for years, nothing much. This cough became very constant and brought blood. A doctor said he had consumption and should go to a dry mountain climate. But before the mountains, said the man he worked for, he must go to Detroit and examine some beautiful clear pine wood. So we came and he died 2 weeks after we come ashore. He never got to the mountains."
She was homely, had no money. Indeed, she wore threadbare garments. But her office experience with the hat manufacturer gave her value, and Lavinia hired her. She sent again for the stump farmer's daughter to help Annig.
"I will put your avowal of wanting to learn to the test. You are hired. You will be paid $5 a month with a chance of more if you do well. We will be shifting to Chicago in coming months. Report to Mrs. Duncan at 7 tomorrow morning. She will assign your tasks. I expect hard and accurate work from you."
Now, she thought, I must deal with Cyrus, for she longed to get him out of the company. His fussy, overbearing ways, his dulled hearing, were unwanted. She had every confidence in her own abilities, aided and abetted by Flence and Pye. And still there was no reply to that letter. The answer, when it came, was so contrary to her expectations she could hardly grasp what she was reading. She plowed through it again and again, sure she had made a mistake. But right enough, it was a refusal.
"Your generous but unusual offer. Prefer to keep my own name. Choose my own helpmeet. Earn my own way in the world."
Mr. Andre Roque had the effrontery to wish her good fortune. She fell apart. She raved and shrieked, hurled clothes, furniture, smashed books through the window, screamed obscene words she didn't know she knew, and finally crashed sobbing onto the torn-apart bed. Downstairs, Mrs. Traim and the new maid, Alberta Snow, heard the uproar.
"Whatever ails her?" said Alberta.
"I expect she is grieving for her father," said Mrs. Traim.
"That is no grieving. That is fury. That is a fiery rage. That is a mad dog rage."
"Grieving occurs in different ways," said Mrs. Traim. The next morning, dressed in black, Lavinia came down to breakfast table very quietly, drank 3 cups of coffee and ate toast and an apple.
"Mrs. Traim, I shall be going to the Duke offices today. I will be home at noon and would like something simple for lunch, whatever you have on hand. And please ask Mr. Kneebone to repair the lights in my bedroom window.
I had a bit of difficulty yesterday, but am quite all right today.
That moment, she told herself, had been her last emotional expression. From now on, she would reject sympathy and condolences as evidence of weakness. She would feel nothing for anyone. Cyrus came into the office smoking one of James's cigars. He had taken the box from James's desk after the funeral and stood gazing at Mrs. Duncan, who sat at her desk, pin neat, in a black woolen dress with a modest collar.
"Who might you be?"
His tone was offensive.
"Mrs. Annag Duncan. Miss Duke took me on as office manager. And you are?"
"Huh? Huh?"
At last he understood.
"Office manager? I was not consulted. Where is she?"
Mrs. Duncan nodded at Lavinia's door.
"May I announce you, sir?"
"What? Ha! Foolishness!"
Cyrus began at once.
"Who gave you leave to hire that woman?"
She shouted in his half-deaf ear.
"Every member of the board save you and me has passed on. I need permission from no one. I am the head of Duke and Sons, the heir to James Duke's estate and business interests, and I shall do as I feel necessary."
"Well, that is blunt enough, ma'am."
"Now, about your own place in this company. It is better if you leave."
Cyrus would bluster, make a scene, but he surprised her.
"Lavinia, I too think it is a time for change. I have wanted my own lumber brokerage for some years. I have contacts with several logging companies, not just Duke and Sons, and every day sees a dozen new logging concerns at work in the woods. Of course, I would hope Duke and Sons would be my prized client."
Annag Duncan in the outer room heard every word. Lavinia smiled.
"Cyrus, I congratulate you. I intend to shift this company to Chicago and rename it Duke Logging and Lumber, as there are no extant sons."
Cyrus started to say something, but she put her finger to her lips and pointed at the door to the outer office. She took up her pen and wrote,
"Company outgrown Detroit. Center shifting. Chicago ideal. Double population in 2 years. Forest, lakes, rivers, easy transport logs. Gale and Shy Railroad and more building. Ill and Mish Canal connect miss."
She waited until he had read this and then shrieked into his hairy ear,
"The flow of business is shifting from north-south to east-west, with the railroads going where no rivers flow. Chicago the center. No business can ignore this."
"Ha!"
said Cyrus, impressed by this rounding out of Chicago's situation.
"Gad, it's true!"
Men all over the country, all over the world, had caught the arousing scent of Chicago, the city of the century, already a central hub, everyone coming to it with a common hunger, coming to take and take and take again. Chicago was raw greed and action, and would perhaps become the most important business city in the world. He decided to shift his own enterprise to Chicago immediately. Lavinia wrote again,
"Board meeting, you formally step away. Please remain on board of Duke Logging. Likely we incorporate."
He read this, gave her a sharp, surprised look, and said,
"In many states, the legislatures hamper the activities of corporations."
"Duke Logging is in a favorable situation as far as the Michigan legislature is concerned."
Cyrus said nothing, and she took his silence for understanding.
"I want you to start your new venture without acrimony. Are Bright Sprechers one of your clients?"
"That is for me to know, not to say. Ha ha!"
He might as well have written it on the wall. In another year, she was settled in Chicago in a lakefront house topped by a glassed-in, copper-roofed cupola. But Mrs. Trame was gone, a victim of dropsy that made her legs swell to the size, shape, and color of Boston harbor seals. she had suddenly fallen dead on the floor while kneading bread dough. The new cook, Mrs. Agnes Balklop, was proficient enough, and old Kneebone kept things in repair, tended the horses and yard, got drunk and roared on Saturday night. Lavinia had a companion, Goosey Breeley, a distant New Brunswick cousin of Posey, who had found her way to Chicago. She looked somewhat like Posey, and her voice and accent were very like. She became official sympathizer, consulting physician, favoring critic, and errand runner. She managed the household, everyone in fear of her wicked New Brunswicker tongue. And she explained freely and often that nothing in Chicago could compare with the virtues of New Brunswick. Lavinia, Lawyer Flentz, and Accountant Pye met in the new boardroom, a perfect square of white plaster walls with seven windows looking on to Lake Michigan, for a discussion of suitable candidates for the company's positions. Anneg Duncan put a steaming coffee pot and a plate of cookies and cakes on the long table under the windows. Although James had hired four new landlookers and their assistants before his fated trip east, they needed more. The Breitsprechers were buying vast tracts of land on credit. They were pulling ahead. Someone had to take on Lennart's old job.
"In my current situation, I cannot serve as company head and still manage the landlookers, jobbers, and mills."
Lavinia tapped on a stack of papers. Flentz bit into a crisp lemon cookie. Mr. Pye made a note.
"You want a production manager," he said, and she nodded. "Let me suggest Noah Ludlam, a Maine man familiar with everything from beans to boomage. He is subject to occasional fits of epilepsy, so cannot work in the woods as a logging contractor, but he has great knowledge of all operations and a talent for working well with men and choosing good ones to carry out what he cannot."
"Can I meet with him next week? Is he in the region?"
"He is currently working for the Breitsprechers, but I know he is not happy with their odd ways. Shall I contact him?"
"Yes, do so. And transport. Do we not need someone responsible to oversee all our transport means, whether rafts, barges, wagon loads, or rail cars? And ships? Should we build our own lumber barges?"
"Miss Duke," said Flentz, "wherever you can cut out the middleman, you will profit. Reduce the number of hands through which your product must pass before it brings you income. Your company would do well to build its own ships and barges in its own shipyards."
Lavinia made a note, but an idea was stirring. Flentz got up and went to the cookie plate. He took two with lemon icing. Pye spoke again.
"And even small actions will make a difference in your bottom line. A question. Do you have stores at the jobbers' camps? Places where the axemen can purchase clothing, tobacco, and other necessaries?"
"No. Is that not the business of the jobber?"
Flentz leapt in.
"Ah, precisely my point. You must directly employ camp overseers and run your own crews. Pass over the jobbers."
Pye again. "Yes, pass over the jobbers. Operate Duke logging crews under strong-minded salaried overseers. Hire the best camp cooks at the lowest wage. At each camp, introduce stores stocked with trousers, boots and socks, knives and axes, galluses and candy, tobacco, maybe even papers and candles, combs and such. Get these things at the lowest price. I can take on a buyer's duty if you wish. Then charge a little higher than the merchants in town, and you will get back a considerable part of what you lay out in wages."
She nodded. She interpreted these suggestions to mean, pay as little as you can in wages, and sell your goods to the workers for as much as they can stand. Shantymen in remote locations would think it a benefit to have a camp store. Ideas were boiling in her mind. She said,
"I have read of a Pennsylvania logging company with a short line railroad from the cut to the mill, a small steam engine hauling the cars. We could look into doing the same. It would be an escape from the tyranny of rivers, for we now cut only trees close to waterways. Some of the most desirable timber is distant from water and deemed too much trouble to cut. Though, of course, a railroad would be frightfully expensive."
"You have to spend money to make money. Do not fear innovation. That is where money grows."
Flentz had demolished the lemon cookies and was starting on the molasses drops. I read also that same company milled on site and then sent the seasoned lumber to market by rail. We need to build our own railroads. She hesitated a little, then said, Mentioning Maine made me think. I believe we still need someone reliable in Maine to handle our interests. My father planned to dispose of our forest land there, since the white pine is almost completely cut, but he died before it could be sold. And now I wonder if there might be a market for other kinds of wood than pine. There is spruce, hemlock, but also much hardwood, beech, maple, walnut, oak. These might have values we do not yet recognize. I think we should hold on to it and look into possible markets for other woods. The Michigan land also has many more kinds of trees than pine.
Miss Duke, said Lawyer Flentz, you have business acumen beyond that of most men.
I learned from my father and Uncle Lennart.
But one more suggestion.
He whisked crumbs from his vest. He squinted at her with great seriousness. She felt it. This was not a game, not fancy nor whim. He took her as an equal intelligence. Yes?
Buy as much Chicago City property as you can and sit on it. You need do nothing with it, and as time passes, it will swell and double, triple, turn pennies into thousands. When first I came here, you could buy a central acre for a dollar or two. Now a quarter acre of downtown urban land goes for $1,500. This happened in New York, and it is happening here in Chicago. It will be the source of tremendous wealth to those who have land and sit on it, hold it. Yes, yes, I know what you were going to say, that you have most of the company's money tied up in forest land. Very well. When the wood is off, sell that land to settlers. But the big money, made with no effort nor outlay beyond the original purchase price, is right under your feet. City land. Mark my words.
I mark them well. Mr. Pye straightened up from his notes and suggested that after so much talk, they go to the Tremont for a dinner. On the way out, Lawyer Flentz stopped at Anna Duncan's desk.
You are a wonderful woman, Mrs. Duncan, he said. A remarkable office manager and a fine pastry cook.
Anna blushed and put her head down. Lavinia thought she was a bit of a fool to be flattered by the lawyer's attentions. Over chops and roasted potatoes, they talked of properties, city lots and blocks, and Flentz said he would introduce Lavinia to a knowing and shrewd real estate agent. She nodded, but her mind was still swarming with ideas for extending her kingdom, and she said musingly, We may look abroad as well. Oh, I do not mean Europe with its worn-out old lands. Europe is not our source, but our market. Yet there are other countries, places we do not know about, not now, but in future years. What fabulous kinds of wood may not grow in distant places? Far to the east, deep under leaf mold and black forest soil, the bones of Charles Duquet relaxed. She knew something now. The only true safety was money. Very well, Lavinia Duke, a wealthy and able businesswoman, would build a protective wall of money. And within 10 years, Duke Logging and Lumber had a general manager and assistants, a sales manager, dozens of landlookers, 30 logging camps, a few miles of forest rail, and a steam locomotive named James. It had barges and ships and their crews, sawmills and finishing mills, 2 furniture mills that used hardwoods, as well as blocks and lots of choice downtown Chicago land. It had Flentz's roster of lawyers who played legislatures, senators, and congressmen like they were banjos. Chicago's 10 railroads covered the city like the spread-out fingers of 2 hands. 2 lots Lavinia had bought in the summer for $12,000 each were valued at more than $20,000 6 months later. She bought as much land as she could. She knew Lawyer Flentz was buying whatever he could for himself. The Chicago population exploded from 20,000 to almost 100,000 in those few years. She often watched the ship traffic on Lake Michigan, noticed fewer sails each month and more steamboats. She cultivated newspaper men who praised Duke Logging and Lumber as a philanthropic, job-giving business of impeccable moral distinction, and Lavinia as a rare and progressive businesswoman. An occasional small municipal gift, such as a bandstand or a contribution to 4th of July fireworks, set off yards of enthusiastic prose. She urged editors to praise the manliness and toughness of shantymen, inculcating axemen with the belief that they could take extreme risks and withstand the most desperate conditions because they were heroic, rugged fellows. The same sauce served settlers unto the third generation, who believed they were pioneers and could outlast perils and adversities. Loggers and frontier settlers, she thought, would live on pride and belief in their own invulnerability instead of money. She learned that small gestures secured tremendous goodwill. When she heard that the shanty boys at one camp had played Three Old Cat on a Sunday, she decreed that work should stop at Saturday noon in Duke camps, and the afternoon be given over to pastimes such as baseball, but that no amusements would occur on Sunday, the holy day of rest. For this, she was held up as a devout but modern sportswoman, and invited to Hoboken to attend a Knickerbockers game. After these dinners, she often sat at her rosewood desk, and, in a habit she had taken from Posey, wrote down as much of the conversation as she could remember in a book bound in green leather. She outlined her plan to cheaply buy up schooners, strip them of masts and rigging, and make them into lumber barges. But dinners with political men and lawyers were even more interesting, and the hot questions of the day, slavery, free soil, and territorial expansion, never burned more fiercely. A well-known senator, a champion of democracy, much inclined to oratory, used her table as a platform.
"The people who live in whatever states or territories they live in have the right to make their own decisions. It is none of the government's business to decide if a territory may permit slavery inside its borders or no."
He did not mention that his wife owned a cotton plantation with 100 slaves, and he himself received income as its manager. The phrase, "will of the people," was always in his mouth. He meant the will of white people, for another of his banners was that
"the Constitution was made by whites for whites."
After all, who else was there?
"Hear, hear," echoed down the table.
People streamed into the country. Almost 1 million Irish in 20 years, 500,000 Germans. They came from all over the world. Germans, Canadians, English, Irish, French, Norwegians, Swedes. The world had heard of the rich continent with its inexhaustible coverlet of forests, its earth streaked as a moldy cheese with veins of valuable metals, fish and game in numbers too great to be compassed, hundreds of millions of acres of empty land waiting to be taken, and a beckoning, generous government too enchanted with its own democratic image to deal with shrewd men whose people had lived by their wits for centuries. Everything was there for the taking. It was the chance of a lifetime, and it would never come again. For some, it did not come at all. A logger whose cheap boots fell apart during the spring drive. Another who did not regard a slice of raw pork dipped in molasses as the acme of dining. The man laid up for 6 months by a woods accident, immobile in bed, while his wife took in boarders who stayed in the house less than 20 minutes. A drought-ruined Kansas family eating coyotes to stay alive. And in Chicago, fast-growing slums, hovels built from scrap wood and rotted leather clustered around the stockyards, lumber mills, and tanneries, encircled by poisonous water. 58. Locked Room. Lavinia was corseted and dressed for the day in green silk, an elaborately draped skirt over a bustle. There was a lace frill at her throat. Out on the open deck of the cupola, the wind was like a clawing, rolling wildcat trapped between lake and sky. She saw two distant ships on the trembling horizon, but looking south over the city with her opera glasses, she saw no slums. She turned again to the north and squinted at the ships. The wind pulled at her black hair piled on top of her head. There would always be the poor, hordes who had no ambition to better themselves. The world swarmed with terrible problems, but they were not her affair. She strained to make out details of the faraway steamers. A telescope was needed. Despite her superior position, she had her own difficulties. The gnawing aloneness, for Goosey Brealey was more like a chest of drawers than a companion, tiresome business negotiations, spiteful rivals, and succession. It was legal now for women to own property, and she had to decide who would inherit Duke Logging and Lumber, the great timberland holdings, the mills and railroad stocks. The wind pulled at her hair. Smoothing the loose strands, she went inside and laid the opera glasses on the marble-topped table just inside the door. The thought would not leave her. An heir had to be someone of the Duke bloodline. It would not be Goosey. She had a swiftly dissolving thought of the human flotsam that came to cut trees, their lives nothing beyond a few sweaty years with an axe. Despite their winters in the forests, they all seemed to produce large families. They had no worries about succession, nor about credit or character. "My God," she said to her silver-framed dressing-room mirror, "how do they stand it?" Her hair was a fright wig. But who they were and what it was they had to stand was unclear. People spoke of happiness, but what was that? What was anything? Posey had had no such doubts, nor James, who fretted over nothing except the most banal irritants. But she was different. She had terrible, wrathy feelings directed everywhere. She was short-tempered with people who did not respond to her requests speedily. If they could not keep up with the pace of development, let them stand aside. James had taught her that getting ahead was the important thing. Of course, the problems and impediments were endless, the brain-racking decisions of which men she could extend credit to, and she almost envied women like Clara, who simply let a husband guide them. Honor and promise had ruled in James's day, but now there were so many rogues about that money and contracts were the only safe way to proceed. Thank God for Tappan's mercantile agency with its reports on the worth of individual businessmen. She relied on their astute judgments. Bad creditors could bring the largest businesses down. And children. Was not that the root of her discontent? Perhaps not, for she disliked the sight of pregnant women who seemed everywhere, especially along the rural roads. Farm women were like sawmills. She shuddered and went downstairs for tea with Goosey. "Your hair!" cried Goosey, clasping her large, pale hands. "Shall I get a little lavender oil to smooth the flyaways in place?" "Thank you, Goosey, that is what I need, but I would prefer the damask oil. Lavender is too reminiscent of bedsheets." Goosey was back in a minute with a vial of scented oil and a feather. "You should always wear a headscarf when you go to the cupola," she said in a flat voice, knowing Lavinia would not bother. The question of heirs began to disturb Lavinia's sleep when Cyrus and his family, as well as many Chicago people high and low, fell ill with typhoid. Cyrus perished in great pain with intestinal perforations. The children went one by one, and finally Clara, demented with grief and helplessness, fashioned a knotted loop in a heavy shell-pink silk scarf, stepped off a chair set on the dining-room table, and hanged herself from the chandelier. That winter, Lavinia herself had many illnesses, intestinal gripes, and skin eruptions. She had not liked Clara, but missed her, missed poor old Cyrus. Under the pressure of these afflictions, she began to examine the Duke family papers for possible heirs and consult with foreign-born genealogists. She found few Americans interested in ancestral searches, as they took pride in being unshackled by the past, unless they had a distinguished early family member, and then they waved him like a flag. She reviewed her relatives. Sedley Duke's children by his second marriage had all died without issue. Lennart Vogel had never married. Edward and Freegrace had no known children. "You know," she said to Mr. Flentz, It is unpleasantly clear that I am the last surviving duke.
Nonsense, Lavinia. There must be heirs out there. You must employ someone to search for them.
His tone was impatient, as if they were undiscovered cousins stacked like cordwood in some nearby cave. But she had doubts. Could genealogists discover any heirs, whether in the still United States or in the Netherlands? The two savants she discovered, Sextus Ballard of Boston and R.R. Tetrazzini in Philadelphia, both presided over bookshops where tracing family lines eased long hours between customers. Lavinia invited each to Chicago for an interview. The first to arrive at the house for dinner and the interview was Sextus Ballard. He was at least 60, Lavinia thought, looking at his old-fashioned checked trousers, but he did carry a fine stick with a gold knob in the likeness of a gorgon's head. Goosey and Mr. Flentz dined with them, and they made small talk about Mr. Ballard's journey, difficult, and the tale the conductor told him of the horrors of crossing the plains to the west. He said sparks from the engines often ignited the dry grass, and that passengers cowered in their seats as the train made its way through a sea of flame. He said that during one unfortunate traverse, flames had seized the train and roasted the passengers like pigeons. "Indians came and ate them as we would a turnspit ox. I counted myself fortunate to have had no worse adventure than encounters with the uncouth inhabitants of Ohio and Indiana Territory."
"A very disturbing tale, if true," said Mr. Flentz. "But I fear the conductor was pulling your leg, Mr. Bollocks."
"Ballard, sir, is the name," snapped the guest. "And I believe he told the truth, as he showed me the clipped illustration and account from Harper's, which he kept in his breast pocket to entertain travelers." He narrowed his eyes at Flentz, to whom he had taken a dislike. After dinner, Goosey went upstairs, and Lavinia, Lawyer Flentz, and Mr. Ballard went into the library to give him copies of the Duke family papers and discuss the terms of the genealogist's employment.
"Of course Holland, but not France?" Ballard asked.
"My cursory examination of your papers indicates your ancestor Charles Duquet came from France. Indeed, from Paris. Is that not correct?" Lavinia felt a burning itch on her neck, one of the unpleasant blotches that came so often. "Yes, of course, France, it slipped my mind. Though we always have thought of Holland as our point of origin, Uncle Lennart Vogel fostered that idea. Our ancestor Charles Duquet has always been something of a mystery. It has been my understanding that he vanished in the wilderness. But do search in Paris. Who knows what you may find? I am thinking you might begin with a 6-month search. Of course, we will pay your travel expenses and provide a purse. And if necessary to make more trips, we can discuss it when the time arrives."
"And do keep receipts for even the smallest purchases," said Lawyer Flentz. "That is the correct way."
And so Ballard, who considered Lavinia a paler, older, homelier, and more modern imitation of the learned female characters in Thomas Amory's The Life and Opinions of John Buncle, Esquire, closed his bookshop and sailed for France on the trail of Duquet relatives, his valises packed with scratch paper, grammars, and dictionaries. He read French, but did not speak it, and planned to write out his questions. Tetrazzini, younger and with a wild red beard and spectacles in pot-metal frames, came a week later. He was more modestly attired than old Ballard, a pleated shirt front with a turn-down collar and wide silk tie drawn through a heavy signet ring, velvet waistcoat, and... were they? Yes, they were. Black velvet trousers. The dinner was mutton and boiled potatoes. Tetrazzini stared musingly at his plate and looked several times toward the kitchen door, but no larded capons nor Pacific oysters came. Goosey was ill with a catarrh and sipped a little veal broth in her room. Lawyer Flentz sawed at his mutton, listened to Tetrazzini's verbose and excited account of his journey. By some stroke of coincidence, he had been regaled by the same tale of the burning prairie as Ballard. Over the dried peach pie, Lawyer Flentz caught Lavinia's eye, nodded, and made his excuses.
"I fear I must run. I have a court appearance tomorrow and wish to be fresh for argument.
"Delighted to meet you, Mr. Tetrazzini, and wish you good fortune in your search," he said, bowing and backing.
Lavinia and Tetrazzini went to the library for port, and she gave him the bulky packet of family papers, most copied out by Anneg Duncan and Miss Heinrich. Tetrazzini's fingers flew through the pages for a few minutes, but he did not stop talking. He had too many questions to suit Lavinia. They had hired him. Why could he not do his job without harassing her for names? Surely the old family records and letters were enough, if he would shut up and read them instead of gabbling on. "I cannot tell you," she said for the fourth time when he asked for a list of Amsterdam relatives and all ancestors, their current addresses and business interests. "I suppose they all may be dead. It is for you to discover." She was tired of him. "Yes, but names will lead me to today's generations. That is how we do it. I must have a place to start," he said, jutting his chin out. She pointed at the wad of copied family papers in his hands. In the end, Tetrazzini read aloud for 2 hours, culling dozens of names from Vogel's Dutch correspondence. A month later, he sailed with his list and Lavinia's letter of introduction to whom it might concern for information on any living connection to Charles Duquet and Cornelia Ross. Tetrazzini made an inner note to particularly examine the history of Charles Duquet's son, Outher, who had been something of a learned authority on American Indians. Scholar or no, he likely had cohabited with someone in Leiden and his other haunts. And had he not lived in America for some years? Where that might have been, he had no idea. Although in the papers Lavinia had supplied, there was frequent mention of a large pine table that Duquet possessed and Duke and Sons claimed, there was no mention of the location of either table or man. Tetrazzini assumed both had once been somewhere in Boston, but the old city directories had no Outher Duquet listed. As he read again through the meager family history on 3 faded pages held together with a tailor's pin and signed Bernard Duke, 2 short sentences on the ancestors' voyages to China caught Tetrazzini's attention. "Well, well," he said to himself, "if no one turns up in Amsterdam, there may be Duquets in Peking, though perhaps rather difficult to sort out from Yis and Yongs." He imagined the risible possibility of telling Miss Duke that her only living relative and heir was a Chinese noodle seller. For the Dukes and the Breitsprechers and lesser timbermen, business was good. Insatiable markets along the Mississippi and Missouri rivers squalling for lumber unmade Albany and Buffalo. A tide of agricultural-minded immigrants, sinewy men, their swollen wives, and bruised children, streamed onto the prairies, all needing houses and barns, silos and stables, needing furniture and shingles, laths and pickets, rails and posts. New railroads to and from the prairies delivered them lumber and brought beef cattle and hogs back to Chicago, where the war and fulfillment of the Indian treaties guaranteeing annual livestock distributions meant acres of stockyards. There was a fierce need for planks and poles, fencing and pens. And if it all burned down every 2 or 3 years, there were more trees in the woods. Endless trees. During the war with the South, the Duke Board of Directors included lawyer Flentz, accountant Mr. Pye, David Neal, owner of the newspaper Chicago Progress, Anneg Duncan, the office manager, Noah Ludlam, who oversaw the logging sites and sawmills, another main man, Glafford Jones, responsible for log and lumber transport, 2 wealthy logging kings, Theodore Jinks and Axel Cowes, both large shareholders in Duke Logging. Jinks and Cowes built mansions on properties adjoining Lavinia's grounds. The 3 shared a park, 30 acres of woodland area on the lakeside of their abutting properties. It was Lavinia's habit to walk on the silent paths in early evening when she sometimes met Axel Cowes and his spaniels.
"Evening, Lavinia," Cowes would say, half bowing. "A fine day."
"Yes, very fine, Axel." Cowes was in his 60s, white-haired and with a soft, rosy face. It was he who had suggested the park. He collected paintings and had an artistic bent. He saw beauty in the forest as well as wealth, something Lavinia found as inexplicable as her pleasure walking the shadowed paths. As for art, he liked pictures that showed stags drinking from forest pools, lone Indians paddling canoes across mirrored lakes. Lavinia favored large canvases showing the triumph of the hunt and engravings with panoramic city views and lines of statistics enclosed in ornate scrolls. Cowes, despite his years and differing ways, had suggested marriage to Lavinia as some men did. They wanted her money and holdings. She knew this. Theodore Jinks, who was a rougher type and slightly tainted with gossip of a gambling habit, had done the same. Yet she did not hold the proposals against them. She liked both men. Both were dependable board members with solid knowledge of the logging business. When Cowes suggested the park, it was easy to agree, though she noticed Jinx's expression when Cowes talked of sequestering the valuable pines.
"Those pines would bring a good dollar," Jinx said.
"Oh, yes, but it is good to leave a few to remind us of our early days of fortune. No one wishes to live next to a stump field."
Cowes had an elevated way of saying such things that made Jinx shuffle his feet and curse under his breath.
"Except agriculturists," he said lamely.
It was no use. Lavinia and Cowes only tolerated him. He found ease in the knowledge that one day those pines would come down as all pines must. Pye, Flens, and Lavinia made up the inner circle of Duke Logging and Lumber. None of them had any small talk. Conversation was always business. The arrival of the telegraph some years earlier had been like a kettle of water dashed into a cauldron of boiling oil for the business world and the railroads. Giveaway Congress guaranteed the Union Pacific and Central Pacific Railroads $16,000 for every mile of track laid on level ground, and double that through mountainous terrain, and included a 40-mile-wide corridor across the entire continent. Now there was real money. Great, great fortunes, of which the Dukes could not even dream. But there were consolations. The center of the country exploded in hysterical expansion. Duke's lumber shipments quadrupled as the Union Army hammered up forts and prison camps. Chicago businessmen joyously mulcted the government with shoddy war goods, from canned beef to forage caps at high prices, and not Lavinia, Cowes, nor Jinx scrupled to hold back warped and knotty lumber billed at the price of clear.
"Why pay more when you can get it for less?" said Flens, who cared little for archaic idealism, and who despised James Duke's timberland purchases when he could have got the same land for nothing. "The government can't prove land claims weren't made in good faith."
They used the General Land Office's preemption acts, which allowed settlers to take up and then purchase land at the giveaway price of $1.25 for a quarter section, 180 acres. Duke sent out its landlookers, chose the best woods tracts, and used dummy men who went through the motions of settling and then handed over the deeds to Flens. An army of preemption brokers greased the nefarious skids. Nor was it any great feat to bribe the federal land agents. The Homestead Acts of the 1860s were sweet gifts to Duke, which hired perjurious settlers who camped on the land for a few days, nailed up a feeble shack of a few boards, the house, shoved two empty whiskey bottles between the boards for windows, ground a heel in the dirt to indicate a well, and claimed a homestead. Others toted around a dollhouse with windows, roof, and floors, put it on the site, and at the land office declared a house 14 by 16, not mentioning that the measurements were in inches rather than feet. Still others had the smallest allowable house on skids that was hauled around to the various claims and designated a livable shanty. Duke bought up huge blocks of land in these ways, rushed in, cut the timber, and then gave up the homestead rights. No one objected. They were smart American businessmen going ahead, doing what businessmen did. No one got rich by walking 7 miles to return a penny. And there were hundreds of small loggers anxious to sell out to Duke after a few hard lessons, being shot at by unknown persons, suffering frequent sawmill fires and large-scale log stealage that made the game not worth the candle. None of these affairs were discussed at board meetings. It was business. Tappan's mercantile report had called James Duke A1. Wealthy family, sound business practices, good as gold. Duke's board was more concerned with such nagging subjects as continuing to outfit all their mills with steam-powered circular saws and what to do with encroaching piles of sawdust. Noah Ludlam, smooth-shaven except for a pointy little goatee, said,
"Them big circle saws cut damn fast, beg pardon, but they don't stay firm. There is a wobble. You can't hardly see it, but that Jeasley wobble costs the company money, as it makes a big wide kerf. I know for a fact every 1,000 board feet cut we lose more than 300 in sawdust. Thing is, the steel in them saws is not good. So much steel goes into rails and guns, we can't get good saws. And you got sawdust piles higher than Katahdin. Course we burn it to power the boilers, but..."
Lavinia interrupted. "Lose no sleep over the sawdust, Mr. Ludlam. There is nothing we can do about it at the moment except burn it or throw it in the rivers. The trees of Michigan are so plentiful we need not be frugal."
"Well," said Mr. Ludlam, who was determined to have the last word, "we have to leave the biggest trees out in the woods. Them saws can't cut nothing a hair more than half their diameter. Bigger saws needed, but the bigger they are, the more they wobble."
Lavinia looked down at her papers, glanced at Anneg Duncan, who had compiled the figures, and said, "All the same, our Avery mill alone will cut 3 million board feet this year, well ahead of last year. We still have a few old water-powered mills with up-and-down saws, and the sooner we get circular saws and steam engines into them, the better. That is our goal right now, whatever the wobble. And I would suggest we look at the new double circular saws that can accommodate larger logs."
"Good work, Anneg," said Lawyer Flens in his stage whisper voice, smiling at the office manager.
There was no wobble in the government's need for lumber, and Duke Logging profited through the rich years of the war. Mr. Pye seemed almost sad when it ended in the spring, followed by Lincoln's assassination. But the South needed to rebuild, and the cry for lumber had never been louder.
"There are rich forests in the South," said Theodore Jinks, "closer to the need. I suggest we buy up some southern woodland and get our cutting crews to work. If the board agrees, I can make a reconnaissance."
The idea was good, and Jinks and Mr. Ludlam, their clothes neatly packed in carpet bags, left a week later to assess the southern trees. Fires of invention blazed through the country. New ideas and opportunities for innovation crammed the mail basket that Anneg Duncan lugged in every morning. There were so many of them, and it took so long to understand the complex explanations and diagrams, that Mr. Pye suggested that Duke hire an educated man to assess the proposals, and even that the board arrange a meeting of these inventors. At such a meeting, men who had worked out logging industry improvements or new machines might show scale models or drawings and diagrams. The board would talk with the inventors.
"This could be promising," said Lavinia. "If something of value emerges, Duke Logging can offer a fair price for the rights and then patent it. Let us set a date for the summer, when travel is less onerous. The company will put the inventors up, gratis, in the Hotel Great Lakes, a limit of 20 men. I believe it has a ballroom that may be ideal for exhibits. We will certainly find it interesting."
The next spring in Detroit, more than 250 miles east, Dieter Breitsprecher scissored out the half-page ad in the Chicago Progress calling for inventors to apply for Duke Logging's summer exhibit. The chance to mix with a collection of men whose brains buzzed with mechanics and machines was irresistible. Inventors did not write to Breitsprecher's. He had a certain respect for Lavinia and remembered how quickly, in the long-ago years, she had learned the basics of scaling. He doubted she had ever used the knowledge. Why should she? She had competent employees, several lured away from the Breitsprecher's. He wrote, asking if he might attend the exhibit, not as an inventor, not as a competitor, but as an interested friend. He offered to help defray the expenses of the gathering. He did not think she would refuse him. Indeed, she wrote back cordially, refused his monetary offer, and asked him to dine with her the Friday evening before the meeting. This was their chance, she thought, to enfold Breitsprecher into Duke Logging. After their longest and most passionate meeting, Duke's board had suggested making Breitsprecher a buyout offer. The Breitsprecher logging concern was worth 10 of the little independent cutters who cleared 50 acres and retired,